Don't Shoot Portland fan page now, where a lot of the people are going there to share information that we put on the big page. People can come out to Lewis and Clark on Thursday from 5:30 to 7. We'll be showing video, and some of the people that are part of the organized effort will be there to talk on a panel.
Teresa Rayford, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Don, and you have a good day, man.
That was Don Merrill for KBOO Evening News. It is now 6 o'clock. Please stay tuned for Out Loud after this.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance. Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot Radio Show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's on Sunday, September 14th at 9 p.m. Dante's is a 21 and over venue. The Sexbots are a provocative, experimental, electronic art pop act based in Portland who have a strong performance art component. Again, that's the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's, 350 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212, in Vancouver at 360-694-1234, or at radiocab.net.
Welcome to Out Loud. I'm your host tonight, Alan. Thanks for being here, dear listeners. We have a great program tonight here on Out Loud. I have a few announcements I want to make. Just two, I think. Tonight is Buy Bar at Crush in 2 weeks on the 23rd. It's Bisexuality Awareness Day. And so I'll have some folks who are organizers in the bisexual community here in Portland on the show for the full hour to talk about that. And some of the social activities and organizing activities for bisexuals in Portland. It is also coming up on autumn. It's not quite there yet. It's going to be hot for the next week at least, but after that it'll start to be Swift's weather and then autumn. And autumn means Halloween, and Halloween means it's time for our annual Thriller Dance. I organize this every year. We we get together a couple hundred people. Anybody who wants to dress as a zombie and comes out and dances Thriller together and the last Saturday in October before Halloween. And why am I telling you this? Every year it is a fundraiser for SMRC, Portland's Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center. We're really glad to come out every year. This is our eighth year dancing Thriller. So we've had, you know, the opportunity to dance with hundreds and hundreds of people over the years and raise a nice bit of money for SMRC. And you can find SMRC online, smyrc.org. Get some information about this queer drop-in center and all the great activities they do. And also, if you want to find us, Thrill the World Portland, we're on Facebook at thrilltheworld.portland. And we also have a website, but I think I don't know what it's called. So if you want more information and you're not on Facebook, ttwpdx@gmail.com. We have folks tonight from Basic Rights Oregon and the Transgender Justice Program. I'll introduce them in a moment. Later on in the show, the second half of the show, we will be talking with Triangle Productions. It is their 25th season this year, so that's pretty exciting. They're going to launch that this month. So we have Peter Dakota Maloff, Basic Rights Oregon Transgender Justice Program employee.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. We have David McElhattan, also with the Transgender Justice Program at BRO.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and Alexis, welcome back.
Hi, well, thank you. It's glad to be back.
It's good to have you. Mm-hmm. So tell us what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. So just not too long ago, we had a huge win for the Oregon Health Plan. So the Oregon Health Plan is going to begin covering a full spectrum of services for transgender folks that weren't previously covered. And this is actually the first time that they've considered this since 1999. So the Health Evidence Review Commission, which is sort of tasked with figuring out which things are going to be covered by the Oregon Health Plan and which are not, made a fantastic decision to cover those services for trans folks in Oregon for the first time in a long time.
Where does Oregon rank on the sort of on the list of states who have decided to make this leap and provide this coverage?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of states that do have this coverage. And I think one thing that makes the Oregon Health Plan, so important is a lot of transgender folks, and particularly transgender folks of color, are low income and don't typically have access to healthcare through their employer. Of course, many private insurance companies do discriminate against transgender people as well. But Oregon Health Plan is specifically important because a lot of transgender folks are an Oregon Health Plan. So there's only a few states, I think California, and then Colorado, and now Oregon and Washington also offer this. And I think, you know, also in there, there's several other, you know, county jurisdictions. So, for instance, the city of Portland has offered healthcare to transgender people and several other different county precincts as well.
And that's for city employees?
Yeah, exactly. But now we have it statewide through our Oregon Health Plan.
Do you have a rough estimate on how many folks overall are served by the Oregon Health Plan?
Oh, gosh. You know, I honestly don't know. But what I do know is that, probably about 175 people are going to utilize these services from the Oregon Health Plan. So it's actually a very small number of people, but the impact is so incredible for those people that it really just makes it a common sense decision.
How does this is a question I think folks, the healthcare delivery system is confusing when you look at it structurally.
It certainly is.
What is the relationship between, simplified, I guess, what's the relationship between the Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid, and sort of Affordable Care Act provisions around healthcare? Like, what does the field look like?
Yeah, definitely. So the Affordable Care Act sort of created a healthcare exchange. So that includes, public healthcare as well as private insurance. And the way that the Oregon Health Plan fits into it is that the federal government gives us Medicaid dollars. And then that's sort of distributed through our state healthcare system, the Oregon Health Plan. So different states have different ways of sort of administering that program, and Oregon Health Plan is ours. And so the Health Evidence Review Commission is the one that sort of makes decisions about which different conditions and which different different sort of situations should be covered and how they should be treated.
And who actually operates or manages the Oregon Health Plan?
Yeah, so it's a board of folks, which are appointed by the governor, I believe. So it's a board of folks that also have subdivisions of that board. So there's lots of different people sort of weighing on those decisions, and all of them, you know, mostly doctors and counselors and licensed therapists and things like that.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does Basic Rights Oregon fit in?
Yeah. So Basic Rights Oregon has been working with the Oregon Health Plan and with the HERC, as we call it, for a few years. Originally, with a coalition of different organizations, including TransActive, we were able to get puberty suppressant or puberty blockers for adolescent individuals, which is really crucial for transgender youth. And then now with this most recent victory.
Good, good, good. Tell us about puberty blockers.
Yeah, so they're essentially what they do is they put a pause button, as we say, on the puberty, on puberty in youth. So essentially, they just give folks more time to make a decision. Oftentimes, youth very early, is you know, young as like 2 and 3, will say, "Hey, you know, this is how I identify. This is who I am." And those puberty suppressants allow them to sort of put a pause button until they can become a little bit older, you know, and go through sort of a more rigorous self-identity process and make a decision with their medical provider and with their parents or their guardians.
What sorts of drugs are we talking about? I guess drugs is the right word for puberty blockers. I mean, these are chemicals of some sort.
Yeah, so they're actually prescribed to a lot of cisgender people or people who are not transgender, and they're actually prescribed for a whole list of different conditions. So they weren't necessarily, you know, made for this purpose, but they of course have that desired effect, and lots of different people, just like, you know, lots of different people take hormones like testosterone or estrogen, a lot of different people take these as well.
And I think, you know, additionally, I think one misconception about healthcare for transgender people is that transgender people are seeking out sort of specialized services or services that other people don't receive, when, again, the vast majority of treatment that trans folks access is actually available to lots of people for lots of different reasons.
Well said. Thank you. you know, Peter, the last time I saw you was at Bureau's front and center.
Yeah.
Let's step aside for a moment and tell us how front and center went.
Definitely. So front and center, for folks who might have missed it, is our signature event. So it's between the two programs that we have at Basic Rights Oregon, that the Racial Justice and Alliance Building Program, which works to uplift the voices of LGBT people of color, and then the Transgender Justice Program, which is where David and I work, who work on behalf of transgender Oregonians. And so both programs get together to sort of address the needs of transgender people of color, which, again, for folks who might not know a lot about that, experience, you know, both transphobia and racism, and live at the sort of intersection of that identity, which, you know, creates a whole host of issues in terms of like economic justice, of course, racial and trans justice, and medical justice as well. So front and center is really a highlight of those performers who are transgender people of color. And it was a fantastic community event. We had over 148 folks come and raised almost $3,000 for the programs from our community, which, you know, I think when I think about fundraising, I think it's always more empowering when it's, you know, for community by community.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So, Alexis?
Yes.
Tell us about your take on this change of the Oregon Health Plan to provide medically necessary health care for transgender folks.
Well, to me, I think it's a really amazing thing. And also, it really helps me out personally. I mean, obviously, being a trans woman, you know, but I am on Medicaid. And, you know, treatment, especially with hormone therapy, was so amazing. It really was like coming alive. It's, I can't even explain the difference between before and after. I guess the closest way would be if you've ever had any sort of like illness or health issues, and they've just lasted for a long time, and you kind of just get into that phase of struggling to survive. You just feel worn down, and there's just those times you feel like you can't go on at all.
Or you forget what something else might be like.
Yeah.
You begin to not be able to imagine any other sort of feeling.
Like, it was literally that way for me. It had been so long since I had felt good that I didn't even remember what feeling good felt like. And so when I was able to actually start hormones, it was really, it was just amazing. It was a whole new life. The world had more color. I felt better. And actually, I've done better now. I'm so much better off than I was back then. So for other people like myself, you know, other trans women of color, need this medication and you can't get it. And, you know, it's just, life is horrible. So to actually be able to get it now, to actually have the state willing to help out and alleviate our suffering, it's amazing.
That's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, I think, you know, definitely what you're saying, Alex, resonates with what we know. You know, there was a national survey done of trans folks, and specifically in Oregon, we know that trans folks are 45% more likely, or 45% of trans folks in Oregon will attempt suicide so that's a huge portion of people. So it really is life-saving medication, and it really is life-saving services. And again, you know, it's things that are already offered under the Oregon Health Plan. We're just making sure that trans people aren't unfairly barred from accessing that life-saving care.
Now, how easy or difficult? And I suppose this is a question that might be a different answer if you live in Portland or if you live elsewhere in the state. How easy or difficult is it for trans folks to find reliable, responsible health care?
That can be quite a challenge. I mean, even here in Portland, things are a lot better for trans folks than throughout the rest of the state. But I can remember, like, when I was trying to get started, I probably went through about 6 different therapists before finding one that I could really talk to, who really seemed like someone who would listen. And then it still was multiple doctor's visits. The first doctor I found, who was supposed to be really good and had supposedly been helping trans people since the 80s and was here in Portland, was absolutely terrible. They had horrible bedside manner. They were adding in all these extra steps and were trying to completely be like, you need to prove yourself, even though you've already been to a therapist, even though they agree that you need this, even though it's very obvious to everyone you need this, you need to do all these extra steps before I'm going to listen to you and treat you. So it went around and I kept having to find other doctors. And the entire process from like going and actually sitting in a doctor's office with a confirmed medical diagnosis and just trying to get a prescription took almost 4 months. And that's actually better than a lot of the state because everything was within easy driving distance. I wasn't having to make a day trip like someone from Southeast Oregon might have to make just to come up, find a doctor, and hope that doctor will actually treat them like they said they would.
Mm-hmm. What are we doing as a community to educate our medical providers about trans health care?
Yeah, I think, there's several organizations that do train medical providers, but also I just think, you know, doctors are people. Right. And many of them grew up in the same culture, where trans people are not, looked fondly upon. And a lot of times they just don't know what the guidelines are out there. Luckily, there are many major medical associations that sort of give guidance about how to treat transgender people, what it should look like, what, you know, the sort of like steps should be in transition. And David, I think you also attended the Meaningful Care Conference this year. And I'm wondering if maybe you have some ideas about what that landscape looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. So every other year, the LGBTQ Health Coalition of the Columbia Willamette, I think is the full name, puts on the Meaningful Care Conference, which is a conference for doctors and other service providers who serve the LGBT community, with a really big range of trainings. Alex helped organize that this year as well. So jump in if you want to speak to that at all. But, you know, I think there's definitely a certainly an effort from local service providers and advocacy organizations to increase the opportunities for providers to get education on serving trans folks. And I think we're also seeing several providers in the community really step up to try to educate other providers as well. But I think, you know, one thing that's still far too common is trans folks having to be the ones themselves to educate their doctors. And I think that's something that we hear about a lot.
Exactly.
Oh, definitely. And I think the Meaningful Care Conference was great. It was a really good sort of like small step here. It got doctors there. It got, you know, social workers. It got people in the healthcare field in a place where they could talk, have discussions, and start learning. But even then, that's just sort of that first step. It's about whether or not that knowledge, they actually take it in and then go back to their practice and implement it. Actually, another organization I know that's doing a lot of good work towards this is the Q Center, and specifically Nash Jones. They actually do trainings for hospitals, schools, social worker programs, basically any sort of healthcare or education related organization that contacts them. They will go and give a cultural competency presentation, trainings. They'll be there to answer questions, give that chance for doctors because, you know, doctors are people and they're curious, and sometimes curious people ask inappropriate questions. They have a setting where they can actually ask those questions so they're not making their patients uncomfortable.
So you would recommend if somebody was thinking that their medical providers needed to get some more education on trans healthcare, Nash Jones would be somebody.
Nash Jones at the Q Center.
Somebody they could seek out.
Yeah, and sorry if I could.
Sure.
Also, you know, I think a lot of times, certainly it happens in that one-on-one interactions with doctors, but especially if your doctor is saying that something isn't covered and you know that it should be, you know, I definitely encourage people to get in touch with Basic Rights Oregon and email us at resources@basicrights.org. And we oftentimes can sort of help navigate from the legal and policy end, sort of how to talk to your doctor about these things, as well as your insurance provider. Because again, there are many private insurers who still deny healthcare to trans people just because they're trans.
Thank you for that. You know, and I think another challenge for any of us really going to see a doctor is, you know, if there's something we want to explore, we don't come in knowing all the answers. We have to negotiate them, whatever it is that's going on for us. So you're having to, you know, you're having to go into healthcare situation, having to educate yourself about what's happening with you and also your providers. And for trans folks, you're talking about something that, you know, I think medical providers need some serious education. But it does seem like, the larger medical professional associations seem to be coming out one after another very strongly in favor of a wide-ranging healthcare for trans people. Is that right?
Absolutely. Many major medical associations, including the American Medical Association, see this as life-saving care, as medically necessary, and important decisions that, you know, any healthcare provider really should, you know, brush up on. Frankly, Google is a really great resource, but also, you know, all of the medical associations have published some sort of guidelines about how to treat transgender people and what that treatment course looks like.
Yeah. And I think I would... Yeah, and I think, you know, for providers, there's also the World Professional Association of Transgender Healthcare, which have a set standards of care that's been really widely adopted. It's what the HERC Committee for the Oregon Health Plan used to inform the decision to cover care. So those resources are really widely available. They're easy to access. And I think, you know, in addition to providers sometimes asking really inappropriate questions, I think we also encourage providers to actually talk to each other and talk about the kinds of care that they're providing, because I think, you know, often I think doctors feel like their only options are to ask the patients, and it really shouldn't be a patient's responsibility to educate doctors on healthcare.
I have a question. I didn't run it by you first, so I don't know how well you.
I'm on the edge of my seat now.
Be able to answer. But what do we know about the healthcare situation? You know, as sort of as a whole, as a population, for folks in Portland or for Oregon as a whole.
So I think, you know, one thing that's really unfortunate is that trans folks have, you know, consistently across the board. First of all, there isn't a lot of research done on trans people for a lot of different reasons. I think researchers don't know sort of how to qualify their experience. But also there's not a lot of investment in sort of learning about transgender people, because while many major medical associations and lots of people are now sort of like understanding that this is an issue, unfortunately, not a lot of people are actually doing research on what the health outcomes are for trans folks. I can tell you, though, they're not good. You know, for instance, you know, transgender people of color, specifically transgender people who are Black or African American, you know, experience HIV and AIDS positivity at, you know, four times the average for, you know, cisgender people. And things like that, you know, in terms of like suicide and depression, like I mentioned earlier, really common within the trans community. And a lot of times, you know, that is access to those life-saving, that life-saving care. But also, again, it is part of that cultural competency, right, where doctors, you know, aren't asking the right questions at doctor's visits, don't know what to check for, don't know what to ask for, or that people have had so many negative interactions with doctors, sort of acting as gatekeepers or asking inappropriate questions or, you know, just not having access to healthcare, that people aren't always going to the doctor because they can't, you know, it is very costly. Rates of addiction are really high within the transgender community. And of course, you know, these things are definitely true within the, you know, LGB community broadly. But what we find is that for transgender people, those statistics are a lot higher.
Oh, definitely. And just sort of to like add to that about doctors not having the education and how that can affect trans people going to the doctor. I remember with my current doctor, and I really like her. She is actually the best of all the doctors I've been to. Even with her experience working with other trans clients, she has nearly 10 years experience. I had to explain to her what the schedule should be for doing like blood work, various sort of tests to make sure I was healthy, what sort of waiting period should be between those. In her 10 years of helping trans people and prescribing medications, she did not know what the actual order was to do blood work, to do tests to make sure that this was being done in a healthy and safe way. And this isn't, there's not a lot of research, but it's not like this information doesn't exist.
certainly true.
Yeah. The Endocrine Society of North America, they have an entire set of guidelines that go with what tests to perform, what dosages to prescribe, how the whole process should appear. And this is based off of case studies from multiple doctors going back several decades. So the knowledge is right there, and it's even online for any doctor to look at. But a lot of them, even when they're trying to be good and want to help, don't think to actually go look and do this research to know how to help.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that we certainly encounter in just in terms of like doctors, you know, not looking at medical research or not sort of like using the resources that are available to them, especially for people who don't have access to healthcare or whose healthcare providers don't offer things like hormones, surgery, things like that. A lot of times trans folks will have different kinds of cancers, whether it is on, you know, sort of reproductive organs, or even once, you know, there's one person who, you know, gave us their story that they just had skin cancer and the doctor refused to treat it. The insurance company denied the claim and would not cover surgery just because that person was transgender. So I think a lot of times, you know, trans folks have negative health outcomes at a higher rate because of things like that, where they're just simply not being treated well because they are transgender. And, you know, again, I would just plug that if folks have experienced discrimination, you know, within their healthcare setting, to contact us at resources@basicrights.org, because, again, we can help navigate policy. And we're also looking for folks to share their stories about those experiences of discrimination with their healthcare.
This is kind of a closing question. I think it's probably the right one to end with. What can we do as a community as a whole to help?
Personally, I would say the best thing that could be done as a community to help trans people is just let us live our lives. You know, if you know someone who's trans, don't harass us. Don't make jokes about us behind our backs. Don't try and get us fired from work. Don't try and get us evicted from our homes. Just let us live and be happy. Even if you are someone who doesn't really agree with transition, even though it's a completely accepted medical practice with several decades of work behind it proving that it is the right treatment, even if you don't agree with that, then at least just let us live our lives. You don't have to come out and attack us.
And I think, again, you know, for me personally, as a transgender person, telling my story has been one of the most empowering experiences that I've ever had. So if folks are willing to share their story, we are looking for folks to be able to talk to their healthcare providers. And if you aren't transgender, you know, I encourage a lot of folks to go to their HR professional, look at their health plan, and see if there are either, you know, exclusions immediately towards transgender people saying, you know, we will not cover anything for transgender people, or if things that transgender people need are not covered in their health plan. And if they find that that's true, using our toolkit, you know, that we have online, the benefits of equality, and working with your employer to make it a safer place for transgender people and to make sure that they do have access to that health care.
Yeah, I think I will also definitely just plug, if you haven't already and you have a health plan that you know has exclusions at your workplace, the Benefits of Equality, the second edition, it's on the website for free. If you just go to Basic Rights and then Transgender Justice and then Resources, you should be able to pull it up and download it for free. And I would also say, I know, you know, we've had several huge policy victories for trans justice. Obviously, Bro also helped lead the way to win marriage equality in Oregon this year, which is a huge win for LGBT people. But there's so much more work to do. Our communities are still experiencing really disproportionate rates of poverty, of discrimination, of violence, of homelessness. And the people that are hit the most by that again and again are trans people and LGBT people of color, and the folks at the intersections of those identities. So seek out ways to continue being involved beyond, especially if you're somebody who is really involved in marriage, seek out ways to continue being involved beyond marriage and to support the work that's continuing, because we still have a long way to go.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Alexis and David and Peter, for being here today.
Thank you so much. It was
thank
great.
You.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. We're going to hear a little Astro Awake, and then we'll be back with Triangle Productions. Thanks, everybody. Welcome back to Out Loud, dear listeners. We had folks from Basic Rights Oregon, the Transgender Justice Program, on. And if you want more information, head to basicrights.org or, head online, look up the phone number, look up the websites, the different programs they've got. Those were folks with the Transgender Justice Program, basicrights.org. Welcome, folks from Triangle Productions.
Hey, Alan. Hello. Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Thanks. We've got Drew here.
Hi.
We've got James.
Hello.
And Danielle.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. I did hear a rumor you're going to sing a song for us a little bit later.
We'll see, won't we? We'll see.
So, Triangle Productions, you are here in Portland, and it's the 25th anniversary, is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty fabulous. 25 years ago, I think I was just bumbling around. My second year of college, first year of college, whatever, graduating high school, I don't know. Triangle and I are both of us are 25 years in adulthood, I guess. But I imagine Triangle took some time before that. You know what? We have Don here as well. You're the executive director, Don Horn. What were those early years like? Were you involved back then?
Well, I started Triangle Productions 25 years ago, so I'm it.
Wonderful.
I was an actor before I started Triangle, and I wrote a play, and the play became a phenomenal hit, and I started Triangle from that.
Wonderful. What do you think is different about those early years and being in having queer theater in Portland than it is today?
Oh, it's a huge difference. When Triangle started, we were actually like the community center for gay and lesbians. Mm-hmm. People would come. We did shows like Bent and Vampire Lesbian to Sodom and shows like that. And literally people came to Clinton Street Theater or to the Firehouse Theater. We were sold out almost all the time. When AIDS hit and when the internet hit, it basically almost closed us down. We lost about 60% of our audience. And it's only been the last couple of years when I've seen a change back again. There's 140 some odd theaters now in Portland compared to when Triangle started. There was only 8. Mm-hmm. Huge difference. So I think we're looking for an audience. And I think having a gay and lesbian theater, it's harder now because you can go on the internet. You can, you know, there's not a lot of gay plays written like it used to be. I mean, when you had Robert Patrick and you had Charles Bush and you had Alan Bowne and all those people that were vanguards at the very beginning, they've kind of shied away from gay theater. It's a difference.
So, what are you?
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. What are you excited about this year?
Actually, this is our 25th season. I'm excited that we're finally still in existence after all these years. I think every show, Tick, Tick, Boom, is a great way to start the season because it celebrates a young man looking at his 30th year. And has he done what he wanted to do? Is he wanting to change his life? Or should he continue on his path? And I think it's a great start. We go into 5 lesbians eating a quiche, which is, you know, it's totally different than a Christmas show. Dr. Ruth, because I think we need to honor our past because we haven't kind of learned the history lesson sometimes. All the way through the season, I'm very excited about what we've got in store.
What comes after Dr. Ruth?
Jutopia, about a Gentile that doesn't want to make a decision, so he wants to marry a Jewish girl. It's been a huge hit around the world, basically, so we'll see if it happens here. And the last show is a show that I'm writing about a theater company from the 70s called Storefront. Storefront was where Eric Bogosian started, and Sam Shepard lived in town for a while. He did plays there. So I'm going to honor that history of that theater.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So let's hear about Tick, Tick, Boom.
Cool. Yeah. Tick, Tick, Boom is a 3-person show. It's written by Jonathan Larson, the creator of Rent. People know Jonathan Larson from that show. And like Don mentioned, it's kind of an autobiographical piece about a young composer facing his 30th birthday, entering into his third decade, and kind of saying, okay, where am I at, and how do I move forward, and do I have the option to continue doing what I love to do and what lights me on fire, which is to write and to create music. And he hasn't had the hit show that he dreamed he'd have by this point, and he doesn't have a lucrative sellout career, And he's got a girlfriend who wants him to move to the suburbs and a best friend who wants him to come down to Madison Avenue and work in marketing. And he feels kind of assailed from all sides by these conflicting pressures. And a lot of what makes the play interesting, I think, for us and for audiences is that it's set in 1990. In fact, the first song is called 3090. It's about turning 30 in 1990. And what does that feel like? And what are the pressures of sort of standing at the edge of the American century, looking into the new millennium? So in that sense, there are a lot of themes that are similar. Audiences will recognize from Rent. But it also, you know, touches on, it deals significantly with issues such as sort of the rising culture of commodification and materialism of the 1990s, with the HIV AIDS epidemic, and with what it means to be a struggling artist. How does that play out in different people's lives, and what are the different choices people make?
Yeah, in New York, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
Where all of those pressures are turned up 4, 6, or 8 degrees.
Oh, everyone's looking at me now.
That's right. Because you have a very pretty lip color on. That's very nice.
Matches your microphone stand.
It does.
Like, perfectly.
Yeah, going off of what Drew has said, I think the show means a lot to all of us that are involved in it. And as we discovered in our opening weekend this past week, it is really connecting with audiences as well of various ages. I assumed that the people who would connect the most were people that were also my age, like turning 30 and being an artist. And there are those people who are connecting to it. But the people that are connecting the most are the older generation. And thinking about their own lives and their past and living during that time, which is really fantastic mm-hmm. for them to be able to experience those things again in a safe way, watching other people live through it. But also this is what's happening with John and Susan and Michael in the show is happening in Portland, and we've talked about that a lot. This idea of trying to be an artist and make a living at it. There's a lot more people who are moving to Portland to do arts here because it's a place where you can come and be welcomed and your art is welcome. And that's fantastic that we have that community, but now there's so many people here that it is really hard to make a living doing it. And so all of us are struggling all the time and having to make the decision whether or not to continue or find something else to do.
Indeed. Although I think Portland was a less wealthy town before all these folks showed up. So I don't think 10 or 15 years ago it was all that much easier to make a living just, you know, coming and doing art here.
I think it's a double-edged sword in a sense. When you have the trajectory of a city like Portland where all of a sudden it becomes a mecca for young artistic types, on the one hand you have this awesome reality of just a proliferation of new opportunities for art making and creativity. But on the other hand, what also comes with that, often especially as a city begins to take kind of national attention or, you know, to figure more prominently on the stage of where people want to relocate to after they've finished their school or finished their arts degree or whatever, is that costs of living go up. The cost of making art goes up. And there's always the struggle of how do we encourage and continue to attract a multiplicity of artists while not pricing out and edging out the cost of making that art. Mm-hmm.
Well, being here for 30,000 years, it seems like, we used to have stars in Portland. There used to be just a certain handful of people that, you know, they would be on every stage and you would go to see them. Nowadays, I think because we have this variety, I call it a bouquet, that we have such a variety of actors that, yes, we do have a lot of theaters, we have a lot of actors, but it's nice to see these actors intertwining with other actors. So you're not seeing the same people on stage. Mm-hmm. There are still always going to be theaters that only choose certain actors. But it's great to have, like with Triangle, James has worked for me before, but Danielle and Drew hasn't. So it's great to bring new talent in and to see the new talent grow. And some leave. There's been a lot of people move out of Portland to New York, which just seems odd to me. You know, I'd rather be a big fish in a small pond than nothing in a huge ocean. I don't get it. But we're very fortunate because we do have talent. Portland is a very full base of talent, not only in acting, but in tech design, you know, in stage management, and even the producers. I think we really, the only problem we have is we've got so many theaters that we don't have enough people coming to the theater because we have so many people. That's been the fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's been the problem. I think that's what we're going to face in the years to come.
Which reminds me, we got to do an industry night.
We'll put the pressure on you on live radio.
Speaking almost off that point, how do you as actors feel the sort of the infrastructure, the support, the education? How is that here as actors?
For the arts?
Yeah.
Well, I have an interesting experience. I grew up in Scappoose, Oregon, where there really isn't much in the way of arts. The nearest theater when I was in school was St. Helens, you know, 10 miles away. And fortunately, the school districts let me do theater over there while I was in a different school district. So I fortunately had that to pull from. But I think the students here in Portland definitely have more of an ability to not only go out and involve themselves in that culture, but the programs are more available in the schools. Of course, you know, with budget cuts, all that stuff has been cut back a lot in the past few years,
right.
Especially with the recession. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of programs specifically geared towards high school students that are really great. Like Matt Zarebski is a playwright in town who focuses on taking theater into the high schools and teaching playwriting workshops and acting workshops and those things. And there's also the Red Door Project, which works more with the low-income schools. And they also do the August Wilson Monologue Competition, which allows anyone to come in and workshop August Wilson Monologues, and then they do a giant competition at Portland Center Stage, and it's really beautiful. And so I think there are a lot of opportunities for young people to get involved. The Jaw Festival at Portland Center Stage every summer, which is the largest playwright festival on the West Coast, they pick four high school playwrights to write plays specifically for that festival, and then they're featured, which is just fantastic. And you see those people end up within the theater community in other ways as well.
Yeah, I think there's a real incredible and just remarkable variety of different kinds of theaters that seek out different kinds of audiences, that tackle different kinds of issues, that have all different kinds of budgets, from the very large to the very small, that produce all different volumes of work. You know, we're going to do five shows a year, we're going to do one show every 2 years, we're going to, I mean, there's such a variety, as Don said, a bouquet of different companies. And, you know, I think that is actually something that's very special and very unique in Portland. And I think that when actors from New York City come to Portland and do a show here, like say they come and do a contract here in Portland with the theater here, they are impressed at the just the vivacious and healthy, robust nature of the theater scene here, especially for a town of this size. And there's, you know what, there's money in Portland, but there's not a ton of money in Portland. So we're not Seattle, we're not San Francisco, but the proportion of that money that gets directed towards the arts is, I think, you know, quite remarkable. You always want it to be more, but there is a lot of that here, both from private and public sources. So
I'll say something else, and that is that we have a couple people in Portland that are actually working on Broadway right at the moment, that have taken shows from Portland to Off-Broadway. We have people that have, like Corey Brunish, you know, and Debbie Coleman and Brissa. They all have been here in Portland and now working to produce on Broadway. I mean, we've seen the gambit, which is great, because Portland is a melting pot.
I saw it in the 80s, and now we're back to that again. There was a drought in the 90s. Of course, there was a drought because of a lot of things. But I'm starting to see where people are wanting to work at their craft and not just do a show. We used to look at the call board after we auditioned and pray that we'd be in a show. And almost all actors are paid now. And, you know, that's exciting because it used to be we'd do an actor's benefit and pray that our friends would come, you know, and God, please come on a Sunday when it's hot outside at 2 o'clock to, you know, to pay our bills. Hmm. But now you see where actors are paid and tech people are paid. I think it's an exciting time in Portland.
And as long as cost of living stays reasonable, then there's good hope for that to continue into the future.
You know. So tell us where and when with Tick, Tick, Boom.
Well, I can tell you it's at Triangle Productions at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. It runs through September the 27th, Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays at 7:30. There are two Sunday matinees, the 14th and 21st. We're excited because on September the 21st at 2 p.m., it's a benefit for our house. Woo-hoo. So whoever wants to come and pay for tickets, a percentage of that will go to our house, and there'll be a talk back afterwards.
I want to throw a shout out to James Lindquist and Janine over at our house for putting that together with us. We're super excited about this.
It's thrilled. And 503-239-5919 or the website at www.tripro.org.
Tripro.org. All right, we'll get that information from you one more time before we close out. Tell us more from your perspective as actors about Tick, Tick, Boom.
I had to scoot forward there. For Michael, I really relate to this character because, as we've mentioned before, a lot of actors in Portland have to have a secondary job to support themselves. And my character actually gave up doing the arts so that he could live comfortably. And there's several actors, a couple of personal friends that have done exactly that. Or they work early morning shifts at Starbucks, and then they might have like a childcare job on the side, and then they do a show at night. So they work these ridiculous hours just so that they can continue to do their craft. And I think that's why a lot of Portland actors can relate to this show. Like Jonathan Quisenberry, our amazing musical director,
big shout out to Jonathan. He's a boss.
We love you.
Yeah, we love you, Jonathan.
There's a short bit where he was working, I think, three different jobs and doing shows on the side. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, it wears down on you. It gets to the point where it's no longer enjoying your craft. It becomes a job.
There's a interchange between Michael, James's character, and John, the character based on Jonathan Larson, where John has just gone at Michael's consistent behest. He's finally given in to go and spend a day at Michael's office, you know, big corporate marketing firm down on Madison Avenue. And he goes into a brainstorming session, and it's awful. And he gets sent out of the building, almost gets security called on him because he's not exactly falling into that in between those lines, coloring in those lines. And they're riding in the car, and he turns to Michael and he says, "Well, don't you ever miss acting?" And
Michael says, "I don't miss starving."
Mm-hmm. "But you were really good."
"Not good enough."
And so I think there's always that sense of trying to feel like, is it because I'm not working hard enough? Am I not trying hard enough? Is there more I could be doing? Or is it time to, you know, give in and just, you know, go a more traditional or, a less expected. Difficult, expected path. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about Susan's character, Danielle?
I thought we were just talking about how the show is for us.
Oh, yeah.
You have a great line. "I am a dancer." I love that line.
I mean, I guess what I already said earlier is kind of how the show is for me. Similarly to Drew and James, it's been making me process a lot about where I am in my own life. And having those hard conversations with myself of, am I good enough to do this? Is it worth it to continue struggling and working multiple jobs and not ever having enough money or having time to do anything other than just work? And then there's this horrible cyclical process that happens of, I'm working in my day job full time and then I'm doing theater at night, and so I don't have a lot of energy to prepare for the auditions to get me the next job. Mm. And then sometimes I even miss auditions because I can't get out of work, because I can't afford to take a day off work. So I end up not booking acting work because I have this other job that I can't afford to get out of. It's this really horrible, horrible circle. And that is a lot of what these characters are experiencing. And my character is a little different in that she is a dancer and she identifies as a dancer, but she prefers teaching. And that is something that I don't prefer as me, Danielle. Mm. But it's a struggle in John and Susan's relationship, because each person wants the other person to do what they want. So John wants Susan to be a performer, and Susan wants John to just be a family man. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
it's you know, and the nice thing about the show is though that there's these really kind of like heavy and frustrating themes that run all through it, but because it's Jonathan Larson, it's a funny show. It's a show. The music is rock and roll. We've got a like crazy awesome rock band, and we go out there and jam out and rock out every night, and it's really fun. And we jump around the stage, and so it's, I think it's this cathartic. I think it's a cathartic experience for a lot of people who work in the arts to go. I was talking, it's over at Staged today, and I was talking, which is one of the theater companies here in Portland. I was talking to a gal there who was talking about coming to see the show this weekend and just identifying so much with that, the process of constant grant writing and scrounging for every bit of support you can get because you believe in your material and taking it to festivals and workshopping it over and over again. And there's a wonderful, I think, relief for people who experience that on a day-to-day basis to come and see that performed in a theater where they can laugh at it and enjoy it. So it's fun in that sense, I think.
Yeah, you have a great spot in the show where you talk about writing grants just so you can have the money to do your work.
Yeah.
And I've worked with Don for several years now, and just about every other day I walk in the door and he's like, well, I wrote 3 grants today.
Don, tell us one more time where to find the show.
Sure. It's Triangle Productions at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza. It's just up the street at 1785 Northeast Sandy. It runs through September the 27th, 503-239-5919 or www.tripro.org.
Wonderful. Thanks all of you for being here. We didn't get to...
No song.
We didn't get to do a song, so folks will have to...
They'll just have to buy a ticket for
come
that.
Come out to the show and do a tick, tick, boom. Thanks so much, everybody. This has been Out Loud. We will see you next Tuesday at 6 p.m. Hard Knock Radio comes up next. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan, for having us.
Thank you.
Put that on quickly.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Triple Divide, fracking documentary on Friday, September 12th at 7 p.m. Triple Divide, directed by Public Herald investigative journalist Joshua Prabanek and Melissa Troutman, deconstructs the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's handling of shale gas development through fracking, and will uncover how DEP and the industry have handled violations within Pennsylvania's highest classified watersheds, what happened in the 2011 Bradford County blowout, water contamination complaints, health issues, and the split estate landowner dispute. Triple Divide, fracking documentary will be showing at the First Unitarian Church in the Elliott Chapel, located at Southwest 12th and Salmon Street in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.